Hi there, Rod here. This is just a brief introduction to the podcast for this week, which is a follow-up to our week on Jonah 2. That was May the 11th that we looked at that one in our Zoom service and talked about Jonah's prayer from the belly of the fish. So this podcast will be three things. Firstly, we're going to hear from Merrill Blair, just 5 minutes from Merrill, talking about some things to consider and some questions to ask as we encounter the Psalms. Then we're going to have Amy reading the passage for us, and then just a recording of the little homily that I did at the end of the service on Sunday, talking about some reflections on Jonah 2. We did have a time where we opened it up for people to talk about things that they had noticed and things that they had wondered. And Mark and Roz and George all shared. Mark sort of reflected on Jonah's reference to sacrificing for God, and Roz talked about the fact that there was no mention in Jonah's psalm of having done anything wrong, and that surprised her. And George just reflected on how incredibly comfortable prophets and psalmists seem to be with talking about their disconnection with God, and how striking that is, I guess, in a Christian culture where people often feel hesitant to do that. But I didn't include that section of the recording just because it's punctuated by a lot of muting and unmuting and a lot of space, and we want to keep these podcasts quite short, so I've just included Amy's reading of the passage and then my own reflections. I hope everyone is doing well. I hope you enjoy this podcast. If you want to catch up on what we're doing with this psalm series, what the process is, and the relationship between weekly notes and Sunday services and podcasts, just listen to the podcast from last week or look at my weekly note from last week, and that will give you all the details that you need. So I'm going to stop there, hand over to Merrill, and then it will go straight on to Amy reading the passage from Jonah 2. And then my reflections. At the end of my reflections, I refer to a song called Drowning Man by U2, which is from their album War. So it's not part of this podcast recording, but if you're interested, it's very easy to find on Spotify and listen to. All right, blessings to you all, and look forward to seeing you all sometime in one of our little Zoom events. Again, as Shane said last week, if you need anything or you need to connect, please reach out to us. We want to support all of you in any way that we can in this difficult time. All right, blessings to you.
Hi, it's Merrill again. So some helpful things that you might find useful for getting into the Psalms. I'm sure many of you have quite a long and maybe complex relationship with the Psalms already, so don't feel you have to take on board what I have to say. Use the skills that you already have. But for a lot of people I know, they find the Psalms difficult, first of all because they're poetry and not everybody is into poetry, and secondly because, of course, they're the poetry of an ancient culture. And they work very differently to the sort of poetry that we're used to. So they feel a little bit odd to read. So maybe just a few things about reading Hebrew poetry, which is one of the most important things is that the main poetic tool that the Hebrews used was repetition. And of course, to our English ears, that just sounds boring because we're reading the same thing over and over again. But if we learn what's going on, it's not boring, it's beautiful. The sort of building block, if you like, of Hebrew poetry is called parallelism. It's where you get one line and then the next line repeats the first line, but using slightly different language. And it's not exactly the same. It sort of tightens it up a little bit, or it fleshes it out in some way. It goes from the general to the particular, or sometimes it goes to the opposite. It sort of shows a completely opposite picture to the first. So maybe just an example quickly. Psalm 19, the heavens are telling the glories of God. His wonders display the firmaments. Where you've sort of got A, B, C, and then C stroke, B stroke, A stroke, it goes back in the other direction. In Hebrew, it doesn't. In English, they change the order. So from the heavens are telling, you get to proclaim, which has got a slightly different feeling about it. The glory of God, his works, you know, you just get that difference in the second line that explains something, leads us deeper into the idea. And it's really worth spending a bit of time looking at it when you read it. That's quite a complex, you know, that's the very basics. I could go on forever just about parallelism, but that right there, I think, helps you get into it a bit. Another thing that the Hebrews love doing is using key words and repeating them. And so you'll get some sort of word or sometimes a concept that gets repeated at sort of key moments through the psalm. And it takes you on a bit of a journey and you see what's happening. For example, Psalm 73 uses the word heart five times. And it kind of takes you on a bit of a journey. I'm just trying to think. Martin Buber described that psalm as a meditation of the heart, because the heart starts off with anger and envy and goes through a whole lot of things until finally there is that sense of being at one with God in the heart. So look for the repetitions as well as the parallelism. But the biggest thing that I think they use, and just like any poetry, is imagery. Poetry uses as few words as possible, but it paints amazing pictures with them. So as you're reading the Psalms, let me really encourage you to sit with the imagery and see where it takes you in your own imagination. I think it's where we link with this language that is so very, very foreign to us in time and in culture. So some of the questions to ask about the psalm that would be helpful is, how do I feel as I'm reading this? Now, of course, there are many layers to that. Some of it are things that it brings up from the past of how we've encountered these before. But just to sit with the imagery, think, how might the person who wrote this have been feeling? And are there any times when I felt like that myself? Does this imagery help me in those feelings? Does it hinder me? Would I use different imagery to this to describe the same kind of feelings? Some of the things that maybe we might think about that are not so helpful is getting really stuck on the difficult language that is very much not part of our culture. So, of course, the worldview 2,500 odd years ago was very different from ours. There's a lot of militaristic language in there. A lot of quite violent language. A number of the lament psalms have cursing, quite long cursing. Now, I have nothing against a good curse, let me say. We'll be having a look at those probably later, because sometimes I think in the right context, it's good to let it all out, which they certainly do. But any of the language that you feel uncomfortable about because of the difference in culture, have a look at it, think about it. Maybe find a way of putting it to one side and not getting hooked up on it too much. Of course, we have to be careful how we bring another culture into our own, which is why so much damage has been done, sadly, with biblical language when it's been taken as a blueprint for acting the same way now. So recognising all of those complexities around things that were, as I said, written a very long time ago, let's sit with them, have a look for how they're distilling the hopes, the thoughts, the dreams, the fears, the anger of people who were like us people, grappling with whatever's going on in their lives and in the world around them, and see what connects with you as you're reading them. And again, keep a bit of a journal, I think, and jot down some of the things that touch triggers for you, but also some of the things that you find help your heart sing or make you feel as though you're not alone in what it is you're feeling. Great. I'll see you next week.
So what I'm going to do first is to hand over to Amy, and Amy is going to read the passage for us, which is actually not a psalm, but is from Jonah 2. So over to you, Amy.
So this is Jonah 2. Then Yahweh sent a huge fish to swallow Jonah, and he remained in the fish's belly for 3 days and three nights. From the belly of the fish, he prayed to Yahweh his God and said, "Out of my despair I cried to you and you answered me. From the belly of Sheol I cried and you heard my voice. You threw me into the deep, into the heart of the sea, and floods overwhelmed me. All your waves, your torrents washed over me. And I said, 'I'm banished from your sight. Will I ever look again upon your holy temple?' The waters surrounded me right by my throat. The deep enclosed me. Seaweed was wrapped around my head. I sank down to the roots of the mountains. The vaults of the earth closed me in forever. But you raised my life back up from the pit, Yahweh, my God. As my soul was ebbing away, I remembered Yahweh, my God, and my prayer came before you in your holy temple. Those who cling to worthless idols forsake their own well-being, but I will sacrifice to you with a song of thanksgiving. I will fulfill the vow I made. Deliverance comes from Yahweh." Then God spoke to the fish, and the fish vomited Jonah onto the shore.
So just, I guess, to finish this time, and then as the lead into communion, I just wanted to share a couple of my own little wonderings. So the thing that I wondered as I looked at this passage was how Jonah managed to create a prayer poem, this beautifully structured, in Hebrew at least, this beautifully structured prayer poem in the belly of a big fish. Because there were, and I think in anyone's opinion, a pretty extreme circumstances. You wake from sleep. I know this is in Jonah 1, which I perhaps should have included as well, but he woke from sleep on a ship in the middle of a storm. And within a very short time, he finds himself thrown overboard into the sea and then gets swallowed by a huge fish. And so it's not necessarily the ideal circumstances for composing a poem, and yet that's what he managed to do. It made me reflect too on a time in my life that felt kind of similar. It was a Sunday morning and I was asleep. And then my wife at the time woke me up, and she said, "Oh, there's something that I need to tell you, and it's really going to hurt you." And she told me that she was having an affair. And at that moment, it really did feel like being thrown off the ship of my marriage and straight into chaos and darkness and turmoil. Don't know exactly what the fish is in that analogy. Maybe the fish of grief or something like that. But it did feel like an experience of instantaneously being swallowed whole by something very dark and very painful. And for quite a long time, I hardly even had access to words, let alone the capacity to write poetry. Which might make Jonah seem like a ridiculously unrelatable fable. But looking back now, I see it, I guess, as myth rather than as some kind of literal recording of events. And even though it skips very quickly over the wordless, meaningless part of the experience of chaos and pain, this story, the story of Jonah, does point to something profoundly true about my own experience. And that was that in the end it was poetry, as well as friends and time and quite a bit of therapy, that helped me to find my way out of the belly of the fish that I had plunged into. Over the following decade, I wrote literally dozens of songs that were in different ways attempts to make sense of that experience, that were attempts to swim back to the surface of my own life, and attempts to give form to the chaos that I had entered. And I wonder very humbly and very tentatively if there is something universal in this pattern, in this story. It certainly looks, Jonah 2 certainly looks a lot like Genesis 1, the creation story, where God confronts a chaotic, formless sea, and through the presence of spirit and through poetry, God creates order and beauty and meaning. There's this a beautiful book by the biblical scholar Kathleen O'Connor called Jeremiah, Pain and Promise. And in that book, she writes about the book of Jeremiah and the book of Lamentations, which were written about and in response to the destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians. And this destruction of Jerusalem by the Babylonians was, in a sense, Judah's collective experience of being thrown overboard and swallowed by a fish. They had order, they had their nation, their temple, their king, and then all of a sudden it was all destroyed. And Kathleen O'Connor says that, talks about the importance of language and poetry for them in recovering from their collective catastrophe, and also the importance of language and poetry and song for us to recover from intimate trauma. She says that finding words for our pain, even raw words of anguish, rage, and violence, are a move towards restoration, a way for a community or an individual to start to restore their collapsed world. So I guess this is one more thing, I hope, for this series, that just as in Genesis 1 and Jeremiah and Lamentations and in the Psalms and in Jonah, we see an ancient people using words and poetry and song to create and preserve a sense of order and beauty in the middle of experiences that are chaotic and painful. Yeah, the people of Israel really were a pretty constantly traumatized people, after all. So my hope is that in this experience we might also find ways to do the same thing. Whether that's by using these ancient psalms or by finding or making our own poems, our own psalms, our own songs in response to these ancient ones. But either way, yeah, that is my hope for this series, that that we find ways of using, creating poems and songs and words that will help us to restore order in parts of our life that feel chaotic and feel disordered and feel traumatic. So I want us to listen to a lot of poems and songs in this series, poems and songs that have served this kind of function for us, poems and songs that have helped us in different situations to navigate chaos and loss. And so for communion this week, I want to play a song. It's called, you may or may not know it, you young people possibly won't, but it's called Drowning Man by U2. And I don't just want to play it because it sounds like a reference to Jonah, but actually for a couple of other reasons. Firstly, because it's a beautiful example of what I'm talking about. It's a very psalm-like song. It even incorporates parts of the Bible. It incorporates a quote from Isaiah 40. But it also feels very current. It feels very, I mean, it's from the 80s, but it feels very now in the sensibility and in the tone of it. The second reason I'm choosing it is because it is a song that did for me exactly what I'm talking about. In year 12, one of my closest friends died suddenly, and I spent much of the day that I found out about his death listening to this song over and over again. And even though I don't think I realised it at the time, looking back, I think I was playing this song as an attempt to give voice to my grief, but also as an attempt to just hold myself together in that experience. What I thought we could do is to eat and drink whenever you feel like it as we listen to this song, and to make this song and listening to it our communion for this morning. So I'll play the song now, and then at the end of the song, so eat and drink as you listen. At the end of the song, I'll just pray and we'll finish. I might stop the recording now to avoid any issues with being sued by you two.